From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Modern Russia emerged half-born from the great gray Soviet Union in the 1980s. There were signs of hope, the smiling, the last Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, glasnost and perestroika, the Berlin Wall pulverized, discotheques blaring rah-rah Rasputin. But under the surface of Russia's transformation days, there was loss, fear, greed, sadness, confusion. Democracy was a tender shoot. Totalitarianism was tried and true. And here we are today, says my guest today, Vladimir Putin, supreme leader. This hour on Point, how Russia turned away from democracy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you remember the 1980s and 90s when the talk was of a democratic Russia, when it seemed like Westerners could party hardy and strike capitalist business deals in Moscow and Russians could speak their minds and believe they were becoming Western? And why do you think Russia's hopes turned to Russia's fears? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Masha Gessen, Russian and American journalist, author and activist. Her articles have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, Vanity Fair, and more. Her new book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, has been nominated for the 2017 National Book Award. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Masha Gessen, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
We're very glad that you are with us and with us at this time in particular, because what's going on in Russia really matters in this country right now. We want to talk about your background, about the people that you profile in this book. Their stories tell us the story of Russia's path with a kind of subtlety and suppleness that is gripping. But can we just go right
Thank
to this? You're welcome. Can we go right to this issue of, in the American media, Russia is often referred to in recent years as authoritarian or autocratic. But you go right to this much more stern word, totalitarian. And it's a word that we associate with the years of Stalin and the time of the Soviet Union, and you put it plainly right in your title on Russia right now. Why do you go there, and what do you make of the fact that people say authoritarian when you're saying totalitarian?
I'm glad you're going right for the my most controversial argument. But, you know, authoritarian is a term that has been used lately to mean sort of everything and nothing. It's I think people perceive it as meaning sort of totalitarian light, which is actually incorrect, right? The term originally was used in opposition to the term totalitarian, and it describes a very different kind of regime. An authoritarian regime is a regime that's profoundly apolitical. Basically, nothing is political in an authoritarian country. Mm. An authoritarian leader wants the people to stay home and not pay attention while a single leader or a group of leaders plunder the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was true of Russia up until about 5 years ago when the current political crackdown began. A totalitarian regime is different in the sense that everything becomes political. A totalitarian leader wants people out in the streets, mobilized, wants a sense of constant movement, and wants a sense of total war and opposition to the enemy. Now, I'm not actually arguing that Putin is a totalitarian leader. I think he's sort of backed into a kind of totalitarian situation in his country. What I think happened is that he created a mafia state. What Russia has is a mafia regime, a regime that's essentially whose only goal is to hold on to power and plunder the country. But it built the mafia state on the ruins of a totalitarian regime.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the crackdown began, society began to revert to the habits of a totalitarian society. And so what we're seeing is this bizarre hybrid of a mafia regime and a totalitarian society.
All right. That brings us right up to date. Roll the tape back for us, Masha. First, with your own story, how you came to be Russian and American, then we'll take it to the Soviet Union story. But describe your personal path threading through this history.
So I was born in Moscow in a family of Jewish intellectuals, sort of dissidently minded. In 1981, we immigrated to the United States. I was 14 years old. And I became a journalist here. And then in the early 90s, when the most interesting story in the world was in the Soviet Union, I went back as a reporter and stayed. I never expected that I would stay for more than 20 years, but that's what happened. And I ended up becoming a Russian journalist in addition to an American journalist. And among other things, I wrote a biography of Putin called The Man Without a Face. And then almost 4 years ago, I had to leave Russia again with my family because of the anti-gay campaign.
Describe why your family first left Russia. What did your parents tell you? How did they describe the Soviet Union that you then lived in?
So my mother actually said an extraordinary thing, and I didn't realize how extraordinary it was until many, many years later. When I asked her, why are we leaving? She said, we live in a fascist country. And
this was the late 1970s.
This was the late 1970s, as we're sort of getting our documents together to leave the country. And, you know, for a lot of people living in the Soviet Union, life there was difficult. And by the 1970s, people were free enough to talk about a lack of freedom, at least among their friends. But there were Jews faced a particular difficulties, particular discrimination, but also had the particular opportunity to perhaps be able to leave the country, which is an opportunity that my parents took advantage of. But what was extraordinary about what my mother said was that she grew a direct parallel between the Soviet regime and the other totalitarian regime of the 20th century, the Nazi regime, which really required a huge sort of intellectual leap, something that most Russians are still very reluctant to do, and something that is still sort of the subject of some controversy among political scientists.
You left when you were in your teens. You came back after time in the States that we can hear in your voice. And you write that you spent your 30s and 40s documenting the death of a Russian democracy that had never really come to be. Can you take us through? You know, we heard it from the side of Americans in a way celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It was a kind of triumphalist story of the victory of an American view of the world. Take us through how all that looked from the Russian side and the high point of anticipation of democracy, if that's the right place, that's the way it was described here, if that's the right description, and then the turn and the decline from that, those hopes.
Well, you know, 30 years on or 25 years on, mm-hmm. it looks extraordinarily naive. Mm. It looks like why do we assume that a country that had been so battered would just suddenly spring sort of into democracy? It's a little bit like, and much of the book is about this, you know, it's mm-hmm. a little bit like if we took a person who had been in an abusive relationship for years and took them out of the situation of abuse and said, okay, now go live a normal life. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't expect a person to be able to do that because we understand that the kind of trauma, the kind of damage that's done to the psyche by years of abuse is not fixed by an opportunity. It's fixed by a lot of hard work, a lot of intervention, and often that intervention doesn't succeed. And so why should we be surprised that an entire society that had been put through the kind of terror that really no other society in the world, with the possible exception of North Korea, has experienced, you know, why would we assume that a society like that, after 70 years of that, could just sort of choose freedom and democracy and feel comfortable in it?
Did Russians think they could embrace it, that they were embracing it?
Some did. But when I went back to write about that, you know, the turning points of sort of the late 1980s and the early 1990s, I realized that there was a kind of confluence of opinion between Moscow intellectuals and Western observers. And I sort of was both, right? Mm-hmm. And we imagined that 1991, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist, was a collapse of the Soviet regime and was the beginning of something new. To a lot of Russians, it actually looked and felt quite different. It looked and felt to them like through the late 1980s, there was a power struggle between sort of new generation of politicians personified by Gorbachev and to some extent Yeltsin, and an older generation of hardliners. And that in that power struggle, ultimately, Yeltsin came out on top. And that gave him the ability to take over the institutions of the Soviet state. and make them his own. And I think that that view is actually quite accurate. What happened in Russia after 1991 was that the institutions of the Soviet state were not destroyed. They were not dismantled. Mm-hmm. They were taken over by a new group of people who I think had a lot of good intentions, turned out to be weaker than those institutions. And by that, I mean both formal institutions, you know, the actual institutions that ran the state, and informal, the cultural institutions that there was never really an effort to sort of face and dismantle, including even sort of the Soviet propaganda. I mean, throughout the 1990s, and part of the reason that I was so interested in writing about people who came of age in the 1990s, who were kids in the 1990s even, was that I wanted them to remember the kind of films that they watched, right? The fact that there were Soviet films running on Russian television throughout the 1990s. I mean, imagine, right, post-Nazi Germany mm-hmm. with Hitler propaganda films on television. And imagine the kind of sort of mushy sense of reality and direction that that creates.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about what happened to Russia's brief flirtation with democracy and the reemergence, she says, of the Russian totalitarian state under Vladimir Putin. Her new book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. You can join us in this hour. Do you see totalitarianism ascendant in place again in Russia? And why? Could things have been gone a different way? Why didn't they? And what do you call it today? Authoritarian? Totalitarian? Mafia state? Masha Gessen also says, a month after thousands of young people across Russia participated in protests against government corruption there, early this summer, President Vladimir Putin answered questions at a school in Sochi. This was in July. Student asks, what do you plan to do once you leave the post of president? To which Putin responds there, I haven't decided whether I will leave the post of president or not. Meanwhile, in the States, here's just a year ago, we had a candidate then, Donald Trump, during a commander-in-chief forum expressing admiration for Russian President Putin's leadership style and comparing him favorably to the then-American President Barack Obama.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing he called? I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader.
Masha Gessen joins us from New York. The book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha, the Russian state and its, if it's a totalitarian face, this is, we get the soft sell on this in this country very often these days. I mean, certainly Russia presents itself to the world as reasonable and just a kind of counterbalance to other things in the world. And even from some of our own leaders, including in many ways, President or then candidate Trump, I think it leaves Americans uncertain about what Russia is or. You know, they hear now you saying totalitarianism, and they think, well, is it really that bad? Because the Russians say they're not bad, and our candidate Trump and then President Trump talks about it as if it's not that bad. Can you please just convey the face of Russia that you're pointing to when you say this is not just authoritarian, it's totalitarian, what that means in terms of reality that Russians live with?
Well, you know, Tom, this conversation or some version of this conversation has been going on in this country about Russia for about 100 years now. I mean, there were people who argued throughout the 1930s and 40s that things really weren't so bad in Russia, and certainly it was a better place than Nazi Germany. And there was a Pulitzer Prize given in 1932 for a New York Times article that claimed to debunk claims of man-made famine in the Soviet Union. So there's a long and proud record of the sort of denialism about Russia. And it's fascinating to think about what the roots of that are. And
I mean,
and
at one
why.
Time, the denial was from the left that was admiring and didn't want to see Russia portrayed as so bad.
Right. But I think, you know, that
now
sort
it's from
of
the
desire,
right.
The desire to admire is actually universal. There may be different sort of reasons for it. But I think in the case of Trump, he sincerely believes that this is what good political power looks like. He thinks it's not an accident that he uses the word control, and he's used that word when he's praised other autocratic leaders, including, you know, the Philippine dictator Duterte.
Yeah.
He thinks that controlling a country is a sign of power. He thinks that out of this world popularity numbers are a sign of actual political popularity. You know, he has a very primitive view of politics. Putin's popularity ratings hover around 86%. That is actually one of the strongest signs that it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a democratic society, not even close, right? You can't have those kinds of popularity numbers in a democratic society. You can have those kinds of numbers in a society where the media are under state control, where people have been robbed of the ability to form their own opinions. And this is a signpost of totalitarianism, right? Where people, it's not like they're saying something to the pollsters because they secretly believe something else. It's that they don't actually have a belief of their own. They have given up agency to such an extent that they parrot back what they think they're supposed to say.
Trump's saying he's really very much of a leader. The man has very strong control over a country. And as you say, I guess that's one of the sitting American president's ways of measuring good or strong leadership or admirable leadership. It's hard, for Americans to make these two ideas stick at the same time, 86% approval rating and totalitarianism. I mean, you begin to tease that apart if people don't even have the grounds on which to look critically at their government. But we think of totalitarianism as the iron fist, as the gulag. Is that what you're describing here?
That's not what I'm describing here. You know, and I think that to some extent it was always inaccurate, right, to imagine totalitarianism as direct control and terror exerted on every single person in the country at any given moment, right? That's not, you know, totalitarianism has its own sort of economy. But, of course, in order to establish totalitarianism in any sort of known definition of totalitarianism, you need state terror. But what the book is about and what I try to figure out is what happens after state terror, right? There was a time when Soviet scholars and then later Russian scholars and Western scholars assumed that once you took state terror out of the equation, once the people who lived through state terror had gotten old and died, then you would have a kind of recovery. And what I'm describing and what I think we've seen is that recovery is much more complicated than that, that state terror doesn't just vanish, right? After 30 years of state terror, there was a kind of softer totalitarianism in the Soviet Union from the mid-1950s until the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was what we thought was going to be democracy. And then the same kind of sense of selective enforcement that calls forward the memory of totalitarianism and makes people scared enough and controllable enough was again instituted by Putin. Right? He couldn't have done it if there hadn't been the background of state terror for 30 years. He couldn't have done it without Stalinism. In the same way that, you know, Brezhnev, who ruled over the Soviet Union for 18 years, and Putin is closing in on that record, Brezhnev couldn't have controlled the Soviet population if there hadn't been the experience of Stalinist terror before that.
So the state terror that you talk about goes all the way back to the 30s, 40s, early 50s. Is that still the sort of iron fist that people fear or were conditioned by? Or is there state terror active today that you would point to as a clear and present kind of goad to terror?
What we see now is a kind of selective enforcement that is a very economical kind of terror. What I mean by that is, for example, when the crackdown began 5 years ago, in the wake of popular protests in 2011, 2012, what the state did is it went after rank-and-file protesters. So there were several dozen people who faced prosecution. Most of them went to jail for long periods of time. One of them is actually a character in the book. She faced charges, and she was not a prominent organizer, right? She was not one of the leaders of the protest. She was somebody who had gone to the protest, who'd done a little tiny bit of organizing. Mm-hmm. And the message that that conveyed was that anybody, any of the hundreds of thousands of people who had in any way participated in protesting were potentially victims. Right. They were potential political prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's how terror works. It works by establishing a credible threat of violence. Right? You don't necessarily have to experience the violence personally, but you have to witness it, and you have to believe that it could happen to you. When you see it happening to a leader of the protest, you can other that very quickly. You can say, okay, well, I'm not famous. I'm not big enough fish, right? But when you see it happening to people who just happened to go to the protest, or in several cases, people who didn't even go to the protest, mm-hmm. right? Then you understand that the threat is credible. And then that memory, right, of what happened in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, I think kicks in. Because it's been carried through families, it's been passed on from generation to generation, often without talking, but just in the way that people relate to the state. And another character in the book is a psychoanalyst who talked to me, among other things, about some of the cases, some of her patients who, you know, in the extreme ways in which that those memories, those family memories manifested themselves.
Yeah.
There was the case of a girl who kept doing sort of inexplicable, cruel things, like she set the curtains on fire in the house, or she locked her grandmother outside on the balcony in the cold without, you know, warm clothes on. And then as the family sort of dug into what had happened, it turned out, and this was an unspoken thing, that the grandmother had been a guard in the gulag. And the girl was subconsciously playing out a torture practice that had existed in the gulag, which is locking somebody outside in the cold without warm clothing. And, you know, I think that in a way that's a metaphor for sort of the whole story that I'm trying to tell, which is that the society as a whole is in some ways reproducing a lot of the practices of totalitarian terror.
There were times when the protests came very strongly to the fore before that crackdown in 2012. Here was the sound of the streets of Moscow. This was May 6th, 2012. The day before Vladimir Putin's inauguration as Russian president for his then third term. The crackdown would follow, but still we've seen examples of this. This was ABC's Jennifer Eccleston describing demonstrations that erupted across Russia in June of this year in protest of government corruption.
Thousands erupting in protest. Russian police in riot gear cracking down, ripping apart crowds with nightsticks, smacking protesters in the heart of Moscow.
And even now, this is just last week. This was Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who hopes to run against President Putin in March. He was headed to an opposition rally on Friday when police met him in his building's garage and arrested him. He filmed it and posted the arrest on Instagram. Oh, police, he says, I understand you're trying to catch an important criminal. The police say, please come with us. He says, on what grounds? I'm rushing to catch the train to Nizhny Novgorod. But off he goes. What about opposition now, Masha? Is it real? Is it significant? Is Putin at risk? You write at one point here that you thought as you were writing that by the time your story came out, you'd also be writing the story of the decline and fall of the Putin regime. Where did that go?
Well, I thought that years ago. I thought when I was writing my biography of Putin 5 years ago, that's what I thought. I thought that the protests were so powerful, they were going to bring him down one way or another. It was an important lesson for me as a journalist because I had never before covered an unsuccessful revolution. I'd always covered a successful revolution. I thought, oh, well, this feels exactly the same way. So
here we go.
It must have the same ending.
Mm-hmm.
But I never asked myself, what does an unsuccessful revolution feel like when you're on the inside? As it turns out, it feels exactly the same way until it fails. What Putin responded to the protests with a crackdown. At this point, not only are many of the rank-and-file people in jail or have served time and come out. I mean, this has been now going on for 5 years, and it's become almost routine to see people being arrested and sentenced for peaceful protest, or even for liking or sharing something on Facebook, right? The leaders of the protest are all either in jail, in exile, or dead. Boris Nemtsov, whose daughter is one of the main characters in the book, mm-hmm. And I trace the story of his entire political career and then ultimately his death in 2015, with the exception of Alexei Navalny. Alexei Navalny is under unspeakable pressure. He's an anti-corruption activist who's become really sort of the face of what people call the opposition. I try not to use the word opposition just because opposition implies a kind of level of organization and a kind of level of access to media that doesn't exist, right? It obscures the fact that the media are completely controlled by the state. So Alexei Navalny, in a way, is much more visible to us in the West than he is to most Russians.
And so you call him what, if not opposition?
I call him an activist against Putin. Right, it's semantics, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to avoid giving the impression or normalizing.
There's some great opposition
the
there.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Navalny, his brother is in a prison colony. He's basically being held hostage by the state. The state did it very much with the purpose of putting pressure on Navalny, hoping that having his brother and torturing him every time that Navalny does something, and this is the case, every time Navalny makes a statement, organizes a protest, his brother ends up in solitary and under new sanctions. And this has not stopped Navalny. Navalny has been arrested, tried on trumped up embezzlement charges, fraud charges. He's been attacked physically. He has lost much of the eyesight in one of his eyes after he had acid thrown at his face. I mean, this is a almost daily thing for him, very much as it was for Nemtsov until Nemtsov was killed. Navalny has basically leveraged his ability to bring people out into the streets to stay out of prison. He is not caving into pressure, and he continues to sort of agitate. As long as thousands of people come out when Navalny calls, the state will not lock him up because they're terrified of having thousands of people in the streets.
But has the door closed on a moment of opportunity for Russian democracy? Is that done? Or maybe we can never speak in such absolute terms.
We can never speak in such absolute terms, but I think that it would be accurate to say that we have never really seen a country or a society, rather, in such dire straits, right? And what I mean by that, a society that has been so profoundly traumatized, so beaten down, so sort of robbed of the tools of self-organization, self-empowerment, even of language that could be used to try to sort of to coalesce and create solidarity and trust and possibly at some point down the road, democracy.
Not even the language. You say that's pretty deliberate. I mean, sociology and political science, these things squelched under Putin.
Well, the social sciences were very much squelched under the Soviets, right? Lenin realized early on that active intellectual life that had connections to the West was a danger to his state.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about what happened to Russia's brief flirtation with democracy and the reemergence, she says, of the Russian totalitarian state under Vladimir Putin. Her new book, it tells the story of individuals who lived through this and the nuance of how they faced history, history that let them down in some ways or never came to be the future that they imagined. The book is called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Is totalitarianism back because Russians love it? Because Vladimir Putin wields it? Because the West got too pushy? Do you have hope in a democratic resistance in Russia? And how do you explain Donald Trump's admiration for Vladimir Putin, a totalitarian leader Marcia Gessen says. Alex is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Alex, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Marcia Gessen.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
My point is, I think that the picture that you and your guests are drawing it would be incomplete without telling people, you know, who's never been in Russia or hasn't lived through the 90s, that there was never a democracy that time. It was, you know, you can call it anarchy, you can call it oligarchy or mafia state, and that our first, you know, after the Soviet Union, we never experienced democracy. We experienced all the bad stuff, and that's why, you know, the people now, they resist all those, you know, proclaimed, you know, Democrat opposition, because people are afraid to go back in the 90s because it was a chaotic time for everybody.
Alex, may I ask you, you've got a lovely southern accent there over what sounds like a Russian accent. Were you from Russia? When did you leave?
I came here in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived through the 90s. I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't that old, but I mean, I can remember the times, and I, you know, I can tell you that, you know, there was nothing, no near the democracy that time. You know, maybe for somebody who was, you know, on top, you know, on the level for them, but for the rest of the people, it was the worst time in their life. I mean, yeah, we were getting all the, you know, stuff we never saw before. But people, you know, was working and they haven't got paid for over 6 months. Some people was working, they haven't, you know, had a paycheck for a long time. I mean, and I think the picture, if somebody listened to the show, they think, yep, oh, in the 90s, everything become great, you know, for everybody. And then all of a sudden, Putin came and changed it away. But
Alex, we've got it. And let me take it to Masha. I'm sure she's listening very closely there. And I should be clear that it's not what her book depicts, but there's a lot of individual experience of that time. Masha, you hear Alex's experience and memory of the 90s, how he would describe it. What about the characters in your book and maybe where they saw the greatest optimism in the 90s and how it began to fall apart?
Yeah. Thank you, Alex, for this question. I can assure you that no one will come away from the book thinking that the 90s were a magical time. The 90s were a really complicated time. I mean, first of all, you know, no country actually achieves democracy. Democracy is a kind of ideal that we're either at any given point moving forward toward or moving away from. And I think it is accurate to say that in the 90s, in a very messy, very convoluted way, Russia was for a little bit, at least in the very early 90s, moving toward democracy. But the lived experience for most Russians was almost unbearably difficult and complicated. On the one hand, people had sort of new opportunities, and they had the opportunity to pursue their passions. They had the opportunity to travel abroad. Mm. On the other hand, when they did travel abroad, they saw that even in a poor European country like Spain, the poor people of Spain lived better than what people had thought of as the rich people of the Soviet Union. And that discovery, the discovery of just the sort of the lack of dignity and the comparative lack of dignity inherent in Soviet life for most people was shocking and humiliating and produced a kind of envy and resentment that I think is in some ways, you know, it finds its expression in Russians' objections to the expansion of NATO and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's much more visceral than that. Right. There was also the inequality of Soviet society emerged. Soviet society was incredibly stratified to an extent that most Americans couldn't begin to imagine. Mm-hmm. Right. Members of the Central Committee had their own apartment buildings, their own dacha villages, mm-hmm. their own sanatoriums, their own schools. Mm-hmm. They were separated by literal walls from members of the Academy of Sciences, who had their own buildings and their own sanatoriums, etc. While people who were manual laborers, you know, most likely lived in dorms and traveled to very bad sanatoriums and probably off-season, et cetera. But it was very segmented geographically, economically. People shopped at different places. When those divisions broke down in the 1990s, all of a sudden people were exposed to inequality. The good food was no longer hidden behind closed doors to which only members of the nomenklatura had access. It was on display in supermarkets, but most people didn't have the money to buy it. And the final thing that happened, and probably the most important, was this loss of a sense of a certain future that the Soviet Union gave people. You had a kind of blueprint for your life. You had a little tiny bit of freedom to sort of make small decisions about your life that affected your future. But you understood what your future was going to be. And the 90s threw all of that into disarray. So in addition to very real sort of material difficulties and emotional difficulties, people had this uncertainty that was just overwhelmingly difficult. And it's what the social psychologist Eric Fromm, who wrote about Hitler's emergence, called the difference between freedom from constraints, and freedom to. Freedom to invent yourself, freedom to move into an uncertain future. And he wrote about the fact that there come times in history when freedom to, for many people, and sometimes for most people, becomes an unbearable burden. And I think that's very much what happened in Russia.
Robert, in Novi, Michigan. Robert, you're on the air with Marsha Gessen.
Hi. My question is, in the fledgling democracy of Russia in 1991-1992, did the United States miss a chance to somehow support that more effectively by perhaps massive aid or some kind of a chance that we missed?
Marsha?
Thank you, Robert. You know, I think that the United States generally tends to exaggerate its role in Russia's fate. There's sort of the United States missed a chance narrative. Then there's the United States screwed things up for Russia because of expanding NATO and not being sensitive enough. Ultimately, I think that the sort of the imperial impulse to explain everything that happened in Russia by what the United States did or didn't do is misguided. I think that Russia was getting a lot of aid and a lot of help from the United States in the early 1990s. I am not at all convinced that more or better aid would have made a difference. I think that Russian leaders made some fateful decisions, some decisions that it is now, you know, 25 years on, easy to say were wrong. But we've never seen a country climb out of a predicament like the predicament that Russia was in the early 1990s, and I don't know if it was possible.
You're right that some blame the failure of democracy to take hold on an inconsiderate, imperious West. Even that...
Which I think is an imperial position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because in fact...
Don't flatter yourself in a way, you're saying.
Right. I mean, I don't think that the United States is that important, which is a difficult thing to wrap your mind around because anti-American sentiment is extremely important in contemporary Russia, right? Many Russians, probably most Russians at this point, believe that they're in proxy wars against the United States in both Ukraine and Syria. And for the new sort of totalitarian mentality in Russia, this kind of mobilization against the United States has been hugely important. But as often happens when a country or a people choose an enemy, that doesn't have a whole lot to do with the actual chosen enemy.
Doug in Cuthbert, Georgia. Doug, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Привет, Маша. I just wanted to sort of play the devil's advocate and, you know, let me back up. I heard a really fascinating term to describe Russia's government. It was called a kleptocracy by the author of a book I read. And it just appears to me that like Alex said, Russia has never experienced democracy. And in the interim, between Gorbachev and Putin, you know, it was ruled by the organized crime, it seems like. And do Russians want a democracy? And the second point to my statement is, are we being biased, you know, through the lens of westernization and our you know, lives as Americans? Is democracy really the best governmental system? Because in America, I believe that our government has a lot of shortcomings as well. And I'm not exactly sure that what works here would even work in Russia. And, you know, I'm just curious to see.
Doug, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Marsha, what do you say?
Well, yeah, probably not the best moment in history for the United States to lord the advantages of its system of government over other societies. But a couple of things. I mean, the term kleptocracy, I'm not crazy about that term. It implies that what defines the Russian government is that everybody steals, and that's good as far as it goes. I think the term mafia state is actually much more accurate because it points to the distributive nature of the regime. It points to the fact that it's really run by one person surrounded by other people to whom he distributes money and power as he sees fit. So it's really run like a clan. And membership in that clan cannot be voluntary, right? Kleptocracy sort of suggests that you can exit and enter as you please. But the mafia clan is like a family. You can be born into it. You can be adopted into it. But you can't leave it voluntary. You can only be kicked out. I'm quoting a Hungarian political scientist named Balint Magyar, who developed this theory of the mafia state and the post-communist mafia state, which is all, of course, pretty amazing because at the time that I was writing the book, these ideas that Russia was run by a family, these were metaphors, and that the mafia state is a family was also a metaphor. And now, of course, in this country, we've seen a family bent on its own enrichment and its own access to power come to the White House. So the metaphor may perhaps stop being so much of a metaphor. But to the question of whether Russians want democracy and whether they would prefer to live under totalitarianism, well, to some extent, of course, that's true. Obviously, Russian society Russian society has comfortably slipped into a state of living in totalitarianism. So perhaps for society as a whole, that's a comfortable situation to be in. But it is similar to somebody who's lived in a situation of abuse, recreating the situation of abuse over and over again in future relationships. It ultimately is, and you can measure this stuff, is just as horrible for that individual and for that individual's sort of quality of life in future. I mean, Russians are living worse and worse and have fewer and fewer freedoms. And I find the argument that people basically don't want freedom and don't want agency and would rather live in sort of psychological and social squalor, I find that argument highly suspect.
Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I see us moving rapidly toward where Russia is now. We have a president with demonstrated admiration of and tendencies toward authoritarianism / totalitarianism. We have a Congress that has shown they will do nothing about him. And we have a very naive citizenry. We do not believe it could ever happen here, and that is extremely dangerous.
Brenda, let me take it right there if you'd be kind enough. Our time is short. Masha, what do you say?
I say yes and no. I say that, these countries are vastly different, and a lot of my book is about the fact that what has led Russia to the point where it is now is its experience of the 20th century, is the history of state terror. That hasn't happened here. People don't have a memory of state terror. People don't have that kind of trauma. At the same time, it is true that President Trump has great admiration for Putin, and it is true that as different as they are sort of emotionally as men, they are in some ways very similar as leaders. They lie the same way. They sort of govern by gesture in the same way. Trump, I think, really does believe that that raw power is what makes a politician. And I think that realizing that, yes, it can happen here through a different set of mechanisms for over a different time frame is important. I mean, no country is immune. And as Hannah Arendt wrote when she wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism, she made it very clear, any ideology can become totalitarian. What looks like a lack of ideology can become totalitarian. What you need to have a totalitarian state is not just ideology, but also state terror. that's a much more difficult thing to imagine than this country. So I don't think we're ever going to sort of fall into the state of totalitarianism. But the fact that that Donald Trump can do profound damage to this country's democracy, damage that it would probably take years and years and possibly generations to recover from, I think that that has now been shown to us beyond a reasonable doubt.
Marcia, can you go back? Or having written in this way, are you out? Exile.
I have gone back to Russia to report. I have gone back to, I did go back repeatedly to report this book. I don't know that I'm taking any more trips back.
Marcia Gessen, thank you very much for being with us today, Marcia. It's great to have you. Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Marcia Gessen, the book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Camila Kerwin, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, and James Ross. With help from Gretchen Voss, Anna Bauman, and Whitney Leonard, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.